I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Cities are defined in many ways. The people are the heart and soul of a city, but its design, its buildings, its roads and green spaces make up any city's backbone. Today on Smart City, we'll speak with two people with their eye on that backbone of the city. First, we'll speak with Lynn Osman. She's the president of the Chicago Architecture Foundation, and we'll find out from her why Chicago scored the number one spot in a recent report on the top 10 U.S. cities for design. And we'll speak with Fritz Haig. He's the author of the book Edible Estates, and in it, he describes the process of transforming people's front lawns into a veritable bounty of edible greens. That and our regular contributors, Walker Smith and Nate Berg, coming up right after the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. The architectural firm RMJM Hiller recently released a report on the top 10 U.S. cities for design. This report looked at a number of qualities: number of green buildings, number of architectural or design awards won, level of public transit, and even the number of buildings on the historic register. The city at the top of the list? Chicago. And who better to talk about what makes Chicago such a well-designed city than the president of the Chicago Architecture Foundation, Lynn Osman. Lynn, Chicago was just named the best city in the U.S. for design. Why Chicago?
Well, Chicago is America's capital for architecture, and I think people come from all around the world to look at the architecture here in this wonderful city, whether you look at the fact that we have these great architectural history of Louis Sullivan, Daniel Burnham, William LeBaron Jenney. We consider ourselves the place that the skyscraper was first invented, but then we've taken it to the next stage, unlike a lot of cities where we really progressed with this wonderful plan of Chicago, this wonderful mayor who really endorses sustainability. We're getting very exciting design in the city, and it's just a very dynamic place to be.
How does dynamic design happen? What is the motivator for that to happen in some cities and not in others?
Well, I think actually in Chicago, we had a rebirth. I mean, in the late 90s, we were kind of worried about where was Chicago in the world of design. And then we had this wonderful, first of all, the economy changed, which always helps a lot. But we also had this wonderful boon with Millennium Park, where we saw how much great design can change the economics of a city. And with Millennium Park, the Frank Gehry design, the wonderful sculptures in the park, the phenomenal landscaping, I think it really gave everybody an impetus to look at the city differently. And it's really spurred on great design of our architects and also great landscape design.
What were the criteria used in this best of competition?
Well, they talked about, it was really a holistic approach, is that it was looking at an urban area, but it was also looking at infrastructure, environment, the quality of the buildings, and how the community related with public spaces. And I think that's something really that Chicago has looked at. And I mean, everything from, we talk about the public parks, but our landscaping. You know, I was just at one of our competitors here, Portland, and what the city is beautiful, but I really missed as I was walking down the street was the pedestrian experience that is happening in Chicago because of our phenomenal landscaping that we have. And then also the infrastructure. I mean, we're looking at how do we build great cities, and we've got, you know, thanks to the backbone of our city of Daniel Burnham, we have this great plan of Chicago where it's a real breathable, movable city, and we can thank a lot of our forefathers for that. And then I think great design like Millennium Park really inspires other architects to look at how they build the city, and they really, it's very competitive.
One of the things that was noted in this competition on best cities for design in the U.S. was sustainability, and Chicago apparently was highly rated on that particular attribute. How is sustainability coming together with building and architecture today?
Chicago has got this great architectural legacy because of the innovation. And so we had this great combination of engineering and architects designing the tallest building in the world, the first skyscraper. But then that same innovation is being used to design the next city. And so when we look at the fact that we have these wonderful architects, great engineers, and we have a mayor who's very dedicated to sustainability, you're looking at a lot of great skill sets being combined to be very innovative in not just buildings in this city, but buildings around the world. When you look at the work of Adrian Smith and Gordon Gill, building the first zero-energy building in Pearl River, and now looking at building a carbon-neutral city. I mean, those are things that are happening with architects from the Chicago that are not only influencing this city, but influencing the world.
So architecture, in effect, has become an export.
It absolutely is an export. And I think that we really see a lot of the work in Chicago with direct flights going to anywhere in the Far East or anywhere in the Middle East with our architects really building new cities. And what's great about that is that as you build some of these new cities, what they're learning on those jobs are also coming back here to influence what's happening in our city. So it's a really cross-culture opportunity for us.
I want to talk a little bit with you about the work you do at the Chicago Architecture Foundation, which really is extraordinary. And one of the many programs you provide is tours of Chicago led by volunteers, highly trained volunteers. How many people take your tours every year?
This past year, we had 234,000 people take just our tours. So it's quite amazing that Chicago has this wonderful appetite for architecture. And also, we have a number of people who come in from out of town with that as their primary destination.
Oh, absolutely. And how many volunteers have you trained?
458 volunteers, and they give 80 tours, different tours, and that's 8,000 tours annually. So, you know, in the summer, it's an hourly, tours go every hour, and it's 362 days a year.
Now, training to be a volunteer with the Chicago Architecture Foundation is not a small task.
No, when I first took on being president of the organization 11 years ago, I thought, well, I have to become a volunteer. How else do you manage 458 volunteers? Taking the training, it was every Saturday for 12 weeks, 8 hours a day. There was a homework assignment, and it was about 25 hours of homework per week. And then once you got through that, you had two tests, and then you had to give 40 hours of tours to qualify and certify to become a volunteer. And then once you become a volunteer, you still have to give a minimum 30 hours per year.
That's unbelievable. It's really an unbelievable commitment. And it strikes me that the fact that you have these 458 volunteers, highly trained, highly knowledgeable about the history of architecture in the city of Chicago, means that Chicago has almost 500 ambassadors for this industry called architecture. I think it has an effect far beyond just the tours themselves.
We train 50 people per year, so we keep our numbers somewhere between 450 and 480. So when you think of that annual renewal rate, is that there are people that no longer are docents that are out there as a general part of the population, really doing everything from talking to cab drivers to being part of cocktail parties, where there's just general architectural literacy in this town that I've never experienced anywhere else, and I'm sure you haven't.
I haven't, and I'm wondering, Lynn, you've not always been in the architecture world. I know you've run symphonies and done other things, and I'm curious, do you think that same sort of training, immersion in a particular asset of a city could translate to other fields? I mean, I'm particularly thinking about the difficulty of changing a culture that many cities are struggling with. They need to move their people from one set of beliefs to a new set of beliefs that are more aligned to a new economy, for instance. And I'm just curious if you think this has any applicability. Could you use it in any field other than architecture and design?
I absolutely think you could use it in any other field, but I think one of the core values that we found when we did focus groups with some of our docents and our members is a city pride. And so I think that to create that feel of giving back to the city is really important. And so we have here in Chicago, I think one of the important things is that architecture is the vehicle to tell the story of Chicago, and it's a story about a city that they're proud they're not, that they're the second city. They're proud that they're not New Yorkers. A city's spirit is captured in its volunteerism, and as you know, as a new Chicago resident, there's a lot of spirit in this city. So I think it can be translated to a number of other different subjects. But it has to be around a certain aspect of pride in some sort of resource.
I was looking on the web just in the last couple of weeks and just happened to run across the London
Architecture Festival.
Yes, which looks fabulous. Now, have you been, or do you have colleagues who have told you about it firsthand?
Well, I know a couple of the people who are very involved in it, Peter Murray, who's the director of it, and it looks like a phenomenal event. And I sent it to all my staff, said, we need to look at doing this. And actually, we're looking at introducing Open House Chicago here, which is a festival of buildings being open. That is an idea that is actually borrowed or stolen from Victoria Thornton in Open House London. So I think there's... with the internet and also with colleagues, there's a lot of sharing of how do you make architecture more accessible to the general public. And it's something as we look at 50% of our world's population now live in cities, and by 2050, maybe before, we're going to have 75% of the world's population. So how does that, do cities cope with that? And there's got to be a general literacy level about architecture and the built environment and all those other issues that come with it that every resident has to have. And so I think that the more we see festivals and open houses and foundations flourish, it's going to be richer.
There's also a London Design Festival. It seems to me that thinking about Chicago, not only is architecture an enormous asset, an economic asset, but also there are a number of design schools. There's certainly, the culinary scene has fused with the design scene in many ways. There are these nascent fashion designers. There's a very broad range of design industries, design-related industries here. How do you fit in with that broader design economy in the city of Chicago?
Well, we're looking at collaborating a lot with different people who are offering that. So the School of the Art Institute, Tony Jones, is really expanding his fashion design. And they're expanding a lot of the design areas in architecture and design. So we try not to compete, but to complement each other with joint programming, or we've actually looked at some facility sharing and really making it so that Chicago, we always say that we're the best of everything, is really the center of the design in the architecture world in this country. And that's where the dialogue happens. And I think that dialogue, the more we can all communicate internally through our organizations, the more the public benefits from it because there's a flourishing then of program and discussion.
You mentioned the plan for Chicago, Daniel Burnham's great plan, and there's an anniversary coming up. And I know that the city was struggling a bit to figure out how to celebrate that anniversary without simply looking backwards, but rather use it as an opportunity to look forward. What are the plans now?
Well, there's over 100 groups participating, so it's a very dynamic organization, and it's the plan for 2009 and for the city of Chicago, looking ahead 100 years. And I think what's really exciting about it is that most of us have embraced the concept of looking forward rather than looking backwards. And for Chicago Architecture Foundation, we're looking at Chicago as a model city because Chicago was used as a model city for many cities in the world when they were looking at how do they develop their plans for the future. And Donald Miller, great author, has talked a lot about how he's looked at Chicago in many of his presentations all around the world as the role model for infrastructure, city planning, for city building. And so we're looking at that, using it as a stepping off point, looking forward for community building, but also looking at, of course, Chicago's bid for the 2016 Olympics and looking at what the next Chicago is going to look like.
Should be fascinating to celebrate those events. Are they going to be publicized in such a way that visitors can easily find out what's happening and make decisions about when they want to come to Chicago?
Absolutely. There's a whole marketing campaign that's going behind the Burnham celebration. And so that campaign, the Burnham Centennial, will be marketed certainly regionally. And we're hoping that we'll have a farther reach than that to really tell people about how they can come to Chicago and experience various events throughout the 2009 year.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Lynn Osman, President and CEO of the Chicago Architecture Foundation. I want to stay with the subject of tourism a minute. You've mentioned that your tours attract 250,000 people a year. Some of those are from the region and the city, but others have planned a trip to Chicago just to see the architecture. And it's interesting to me that is a real spinoff and unexpected spinoff benefit of having great architecture. No one built it to attract tourists, but in fact, that's part of what it does. I noticed that your river cruises, which are, of course, fabulous, and everybody who comes to Chicago wants to do the river cruise, and that's often the highlight of their trip, where you take the river cruise on the Chicago River and point out the fabulous buildings that can be seen from the river. just got named the number one tourist attraction in the state of Illinois by Travel and Leisure. That's a nice designation.
It was fabulous, and it was quite a coincidence because this is our 25th year of offering it. And so 25 years ago, we had a volunteer, Bob Irving, who actually created the tour for us. And then over the years, we've modified it, and now we have three boats on the river. And the tour alone, last year it was 175,000 people took the river cruise alone. What's interesting, too, is that we have created this whole architectural tourism industry in Chicago, and now we have every boat is doing an architecture river cruise. I would say not as good as ours and not with the training of our people, but we've also fostered a lot of competition, which is great to see that there's this whole tourism industry based on architecture, based on a model that was started 25 years ago by the Chicago Architecture Foundation. The boat tour has been going for 25 years, but the organization's been around since 1966, and we've been doing architectural tours since almost then. And I think it's really caught on across the country because of what's happening here in Chicago. We've taught people who come to town to say when they go to another city, do you have architectural tours? And it's interesting to see how many cities who don't have that, but hopefully we'll start having that.
And they consult you about how to do it?
Absolutely. We're starting an Association of Architecture Organizations. That's the National Endowment for the Arts is funding a conference next year. And one of the aspects of that will be not only architectural programs, but starting an architectural tour program as well.
Well, that's exciting. What's next for you? What's your next frontier?
Well, for our organization, we're looking at expanding. We're actually, we're now facility strapped. We have these wonderful architecture tours, but last year, we put on 110 programs alone about architecture and symposia, landscaping, infrastructure. We have exhibits, but they've also outgrown where we're currently located. So we're in a real estate hunt right now to try to expand our facility and really to become the premier architectural destination in the country.
At one point, I know you were thinking about doing that in league with other organizations in similar fields, in related fields. Are you still looking at that, or are you going off on your own?
Certainly, there's other like-minded institutions in the city that we would love to partner with, including the American Institute of Architects, the American Planning Association, and like-minded organizations that would really benefit from being in an expanded facility where not only are there tour programs, but lectures, symposia, exhibits that really garner a lot of the people that come to the city or are in the city that really want to talk about the built environment and really having a very creative Chicago design community.
I think that would be so exciting. How do you keep the standards high in a distressed economy?
Well, we're fortunate, not wood, that our organization continues to grow in this economy. Tourism is very strong. And also, I think Chicago's reputation abroad is getting very high because of this Olympic bid of 2016. And I think because of what we have done with the city, then we continue to grow in our programming areas because the interest in the built environment is just growing. It's a growing area of concern and of interest. And people want to understand what does sustainability mean? So I think we have certainly hired a phenomenal staff, have a great board, and really and volunteers, and continue to look at the standards.
Which buildings are the favorites of Chicagoans?
I think the landmark buildings are always the Rookery by Daniel Burnham, the John Hancock by SOM, certainly the Sears Tower, and that's because it's bold and brave, and everybody likes to still say it's the tallest building in the world. And 110 stories, it's still the tallest occupied floor in the world. And then, of course, the Tribune and the Wrigley are always very well liked by everybody. And then on the river, I think the favorite one is 333 Wacker because it's very contextual and is a glass building that allows you, when you're going down, floating down the river, to look at it. And sometimes you'll see the merchandise mart reflected in it. Other times you'll see the clouds and the tour boats actually reflected in it. So it's a story that tells the weather and the surroundings of Chicago.
I told my husband after taking one of your tours through the Rookery, if they ever convert it to condos, I'm there. You know, I'm moving out of wherever I am. I'm moving into the Rookery. What a fabulous, fabulous building. It's got such an interesting story to it, too.
Oh, it does. I mean, because it was created by Daniel Burnham and John Welborn Root, and it was done right after, not too long after the city burned down. So it was on, the Rookery was actually the location of where the city hall was, and there was a lot of rooks at that time in that area, rooks, birds. And so when it was named, it was called the Rookery. And the Brooks brothers from Boston, not Brooks Brothers Clothing, built it, commissioned it, and really wanted to have a bit of fun with the theme, so that you'll see the rook embedded in both the elevator, in the front stones outside. And then, because at the time, Root was very interested in Islamic architecture. So he actually, there's a lot of Islamic influences in the building itself. And so it's a really wonderful Chicago-style building, but far more ornate than most of the buildings are in Chicago.
And at one time, didn't Frank Lloyd Wright go back in and do something with that building?
Yeah, actually what happened is that the lobby was all done in ironwork, and it was very dark, very elaborate, very dark. So Frank Lloyd Wright was commissioned at the turn of the century to go in and actually brighten it up. So he did a lot of his marble and his stenciling and changed it into more of a prairie-style sort of building with the urns and with the lamps. And so it's got this really wonderful, very bright interior because of its central atrium and the marble that just shimmers in a bright day. And then this very majestic red brick on the outside, the exterior.
Well, since you're the president and CEO of the Chicago Architecture Foundation, I expect you to have inside information when and if this building converts. So I expect to get the first phone call from you.
I've heard a few buildings on the market. That's not one, Carol.
Oh, that's too bad.
Lynn Osmond is the president of the Chicago Architecture Foundation. For more information on the foundation and the tours Lynn mentioned, point your browsers to architecture.org. For the latest news in the world of urban design and planning, we turn to Nate Berg from planetizen.com.
This week, we're changing our focus slightly to present a series of recent news stories on one topic, in this case, architecture. Urban planners and architects regularly clash over the design of buildings and how they, quote, meet the street. Planners are more likely to push a comfortable status quo, emphasizing regulations developed over decades of public comment and focusing on street life. Architects, meanwhile, are more likely to be pushing the envelope and developing exciting new ideas that may or may not relate to how a human would actually use the space. Both sides have a point, and the push and pull between these two opposing forces creates dynamic pressures on a city that hopefully result in great places and great buildings. Architect David Fisher did his part for innovative design recently, announcing a new 80-story tower his firm is constructing in Dubai. Two things make this building different from even the most radical designs currently happening in Dubai. One, it is entirely prefabricated construction. And two, each floor rotates. Tired of your view? Or is the sun in your eyes? This dynamic building allows you to rotate independently whenever you choose. As Fisher said in an interview with the BBC, quote, "This building never looks the same, not once in a lifetime." Architect John Field, on the other hand, rails against attention-getting buildings in a recent op-ed written for Planetizen. He calls such buildings, quote, "autograph architecture," sweeping, aggressive, personal statement buildings that plaster the architect's vision across the urban skyline, saying, "Look at me." Field says that this trend towards celebrity architecture is ruining the fabric of urban communities because they break the rules of civic engagement. The serious challenge for the profession today, Field claims, is not how to make a city icon, but rather to find ways to bring a satisfying humanity to the urban density that will house our growing population. And as trends in environmental consciousness gain acceptance, the concept of green building has gotten a lot of attention. Buildings account for a huge proportion of our energy consumption, so creating buildings that use less energy makes them smarter in the long run and cheaper. But a recent article in the Christian Science Monitor asks why they all have to be so ugly. Architects are griping about some of the new green designs coming out for being too focused on their greenness and not enough on their aesthetics. Green building is still in its early stages, though, so many just think it's steadying itself out right now. As the construction materials and design techniques that make these buildings green become more widely accessible, the green building may start to get the respect and the beauty it deserves. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, we'll speak with Fritz Haig. He's the author of Edible Estates, and we'll find out how he transforms front lawns into salad bars. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Fritz Haig is an artist and architect in San Francisco. His latest project is to uproot the grass from America's front lawns and replace it with edible fruits, herbs, and vegetables. He's written a book about the first batch of these edible estates. Our producer, Scotty Iseri, spoke to Fritz from his home in San Francisco.
In your book, Edible Estates, you write that the book is an attack on the front lawn and everything it has come to represent. What exactly does the front lawn represent?
Well, it's kind of this amazing combination of all of these things, what it represents and what it actually does. I think for a lot of people, it epitomizes the American dream. It appears on the surface to be quite a pleasant space, but if you look a little deeper into its actual effect on the environment and how we're living, I think it's actually a pretty insidious space. And I'm focused here just particularly on the front lawn because it's typically a space that goes completely unused and is mostly ornamental. So what I'm interested in specifically is how this space that we really take for granted continues to spread across our country from coast to coast. We use chemicals on it to prevent any other form of life from happening there aside from this grass. We mow it, thereby polluting the air. We dump precious water on it, especially in places like Southern California. That's a huge problem, which immediately becomes toxified with the chemicals and grows into the groundwater. And then we don't even spend time there. So specifically, I'm looking at how that wasteful, unproductive space that actually isolates from us from our neighbors in our community can be transformed into a productive space that produces food, but also reconnects us to what's happening around us, to the street, to our neighbors. I think that front lawn is just this really critical moment between our private homes and the public space of the street where, you know, depending on what happens there, it can further isolate us or it can actually be actively used to re-engage us in ways that I think people are craving more in their daily lives.
What exactly about this moment makes it a critical moment?
Well, there's the moment of this month, I suppose, with the headlines about food, which I think, you know, there's always the few top headlines of the moment that the press is always interested in. It. I think it so happens this month food has been right up there. But in general, I think just since I've been doing the project since 2005, there's been a real growing interest in food and where food is coming from. I think people are becoming more aware of that. You know, this sort of project of growing food in our cities, there's nothing even remotely new about it. It comes back into vogue or it comes into interest whenever there's a crisis or whenever our supplies of food are becoming less secure. We saw it after the oil embargo in the 70s, a moment of interest. In the 80s, we saw a little resurgence of it. A great book by Rosalind Creasy called The Complete Guide to Edible Landscaping had a big effect. But, you know, really growing your own food is the most basic kind of human activity that exists. And it's so fundamentally human and it's so basic to who we are. And yet we're so disconnected from it in our daily lives and in our cities that I think it's a little funny and a little sad that even growing your own food today is worthy of news, you know. And now there's constant stories every day in the news about people in cities looking at how they can produce their own food in more creative ways, like guerrilla gardening in London and things like that.
Could you describe an edible estate for me? What does it look like and what kind of things do you grow?
My little project is just a few gardens and it's just narrowly focused on 9 specific gardens that I'm planting. Like Thomas Jefferson, I've divided the country up into a grid, into 9 squares. And my goal is in each one of those squares to make one edible estate garden for a family in a neighborhood where a garden like this is least likely. And each garden will serve as a regional prototype for that area, like some sort of model for people to look at. So the gardens are on streets with endless lawns. And when they're planted, they're a really vibrant contrast with everything around them. Since it's not a commercial project and they're all commissioned by art institutions or museums, I start the project on the same page with the family. They've contacted me. If it was a commercial project, people would hire me, let's say, and say, well, we just want a few tomatoes, but these gardens are meant to be more extreme. So the garden is basically covers the entire front lawn. It's removing the entire front lawn, planting it entirely with edibles, which can be, you know, which sounds specific enough, but actually there's a huge, amazing amount of variety just within that. I mean, that spans deciduous fruit trees that, once they get established, require very little care or maintenance, down to annual perennials and vegetables, which require a lot more time. But I typically like to do gardens that anyone could do by themselves. I don't like fantasy gardens or ridiculous magazine gardens that are meant to inspire envy or design porn magazines where you're just, it's all about aspiration for something you can never have. I want these gardens to be down and dirty, like productive gardens that once they grow in are really beautiful just because of the plants that are there, not because of any fussy materials or expensive furniture or hardscaping or something like that. So hopefully there's some sort of design and structure to them that will be permanent, like how the paths are made and where people hang out and where the trees are. And then there's a lot of room for freedom for it to develop over time. You know, I work with families that are avid gardeners that have grown food in that region before, and also try as much as possible to be in touch with local experts that can advise on it too, because being a gardener in California, you can't presume anything by going to New Jersey, really. I mean, there's certain skills you can take with you, but it's a very climate-oriented kind of craft and science, and I think you have to be gardening in a place for a certain amount of time to understand it. So, yeah, I mean, you know, a lawn, you can, it's the same anywhere in the planet, but a garden producing food is depends wildly based on region, street, or even the family. And that's the idea with this edible estate gardens. Each one is different. And if there was a whole street full of them and everyone did this, they'd all be wildly different.
Interesting. So I saw that you picked Salina, Kansas for the very first garden of this type. And how did you pick Kansas?
I actually decided to do a project in Kansas before I knew it was going to even be a garden at all, or a lawn or anything edible. And I just really wanted to do a project that looked at how we're living today, at our entire country and all of our experience collectively, and not isolated by red or blue, but what we share. And I decided symbolically to do a project in the geographic center of the country. And only once I got there did I come upon the front lawn as really the perfect space to work, because we all share collectively. It cuts across all boundaries in our society, economic, religious, political, racial, geographic. You know, we all collectively share and believe in the space of the front lawn. So it really started with that first. And then, you know, the idea of transforming this polluting, wasteful, isolating space into something productive and engaging.
Now, was this a commission, or was this being the first one, was it more self-motivated?
The first project was commissioned by the Salina Art Center, which is a wonderful nonprofit art organization in Salina, Kansas. And it's amazing that a town that small has an art center that's sophisticated, but it's a really wonderful institution. And Salina also happens to be the home for the Land Institute, which was founded by Wes Jackson, and they're doing remarkable research on global food production and how we can grow food in ways that's more responsive to the local climate, as opposed to our kind of industrial agriculture today that relies on a monoculture. So interestingly enough, the owner for the first garden in Salina, Kansas is Stan Cox, who's a plant biologist with the Land Institute. So that was a really perfect place to start the project, aside from its symbolic significance in the center of the country. And also, coincidentally, we happened to plant it on Independence Day 2005.
What kind of reactions do you get from people when they see one of these?
Well, it totally depends. It depends on the city and the neighborhood and who sees it. I think there's a difference in reactions between the people that read about it or see videos or read stories in the press or something, and those who actually experience it firsthand. There's a very, very small percentage who are always somewhat resistant and a little skeptical. But all of them usually come around once it fills in after the first season. And, you know, I specifically want to place the gardens that I'm doing in very unlikely situations. also for people who couldn't necessarily afford to hire a landscape designer or a crew to do this in a weekend. So it's giving this a chance to happen in places that it otherwise wouldn't. And then being a demonstration to the neighbors. And I think once it's in, people really grow to love it, because how can you not love a garden where you're seeing someone working on it every day and it's producing food? And I mean, I happen to think a productive vegetable garden is one of the most beautiful things there is. And it's something that I think for most Americans, we don't see enough of, or we're not familiar enough with. I think we have this kind of default reaction to what we think is appropriate in the landscape, particularly a front yard, which is, we have this very antiquated ideas about what's appropriate there. And part of the point of the project is shifting these ideas of what's beautiful. You know, even a vegetable garden that's going through the late stages of fall harvest, where corn stalks are drying up, can also be beautiful. And it's something I don't think we welcome enough in our landscape. That sort of evidence of death, let's say, that then leads to the next life in the spring.
I was going to say, looking at the pictures on the website, the gardens look gorgeous. So I'm curious as to what kind of objections people would have. Are they aesthetic objections?
I think most residents or people in neighborhoods really grow to love them. I know they're all so different. I mean, the one I did in Austin, Texas, is for a very large apartment complex in South Austin. All the residents and all, especially the children, are very involved in that garden. And by the way, all the gardens are still running. They're meant to be permanent as long as the families are there. And specifically working with families that are interested in doing this permanently, or there's local organizations, for example, with the apartment complex that are working on them. The one in London, which I just visited again last week after a year of growth, is doing really great. So I think everyone in the neighborhoods really loves them. Strangely, I think, I don't know. I mean, my background is in architecture, and you know, right now all these projects are being commissioned by museums. So I'm kind of an outsider in the gardening world. I'm not a horticulturist. I'm not a professional gardener by trade. I'm really an amateur. There's so many people that have been doing this kind of work so much longer than I have. So I think there's a certain number of gardeners who in those positions who probably are a little bit skeptical of what I'm doing, let's say. I don't know. Aside from that, I think the people around them tend to really like them as they grow in, even if at first they might cause a little, you know, raise eyebrows a little bit.
To switch tack a little bit, if I wanted to do this in my yard, what do I need to do?
Well, you know, these gardens that I'm doing, I'm being as extreme as possible, putting out into the world the possibility, what if? Beyond that, I'm interested to see what happens. I mean, part of the point of these gardens is to reveal some truths about the world that we're living in, and to engage in some conversation and thought about that, and to have these projects be these kind of provocations in a way, with the idea that if you go full out to the extreme with these kind of things, the way they manifest themselves into a wider movement can be much more watered down. So there's an infinite number of ways someone could do this. You can start out very modestly, the way someone writes in the book, every year removing a little bit more of the lawn. Maybe the planting beds come out a foot every year, and by the time you've planted the whole front with edibles, your neighbors never even noticed. And maybe a lower maintenance edible garden could be entirely perennial berry bushes, fruit trees, and vines that require, as I said, very little maintenance and maybe even very little water once they get established, with some perennial herbs, borders or something like that. So, you know, that's the sort of landscape that's very easy to take care of, that can be very productive, and maybe you can trade plums with your neighbor who's growing eggplants or something like that. The gardens that I do tend to be much more complicated in terms of the plants. I literally want to find every single edible thing that grows in that region and plant it. So it's extremely diverse and very dense. And then the family can see over time what works for them and what doesn't, or what they like and what they don't like. Because you never really learn about plants until you grow them yourself for at least a year or two. So if you wanted to do this yourself, you could get some friends together, remove your entire lawn, and come up with a list of things you like to eat. Or maybe the parameters are about how much time you have to take care of a landscape like this, which can be quite time-consuming if all annuals, let's say. But, you know, there's a lot of great books out there, how-to books on, you know, growing food. As I said, there's Rosalind Creasy's Complete Guide of Edible Landscaping. You know, my book is more, in a way, kind of a storybook with these essays by Michael Pollan and Rosalind Creasy, but also stories by the homeowners that I've worked with, their kind of blogs and essays that they've written about their experiences and things like that.
I was reading in the news this morning there's a man in Boulder who was gardening a patch of, it's the green space between the sidewalk and the road, which is technically public property, and he was running into some legal trouble there. And I'm wondering if you've ever run into any zoning issues or any legal problems, any problems with city government as far as creating one of these gardens.
I get emails from people all the time living in places where they can't do this or they're not sure if they can. I think Sacramento is some place where they're dealing with this now. So I'd love to plant one of these gardens in a place where it is illegal, because I think that would be kind of amazing. Like where private property owners are not allowed to grow food on their own property, I think, that's kind of amazing, you know? And I don't think it can last much longer. I think there is this groundswell of interest in this sort of thing, and local governments are kind of realizing how out of touch they are when they have legislation that prevents people from growing food. It's kind of laughable, I think. But that strip of land, city-owned land between the sidewalk and the street, I tend not to plant there because I'm really interested in private property. I'm interested in all these projects opening up the possibilities of what people can do with the land that they own. And I like dealing with just individual families. And let me clarify something, too. Everyone growing their own food in their front yard is not going to solve the global food crisis, and it's not going to solve any kind of environmental crisis that we're in. But I do think the powerful thing about it is that once people are growing some amount of food, they're starting a chain reaction of thought that extends out into where food is coming from, how we're living, what's the quality of my soil, what's the quality of my environment. Children are becoming aware of where food comes from, that it doesn't come grown inside a shrink-wrapped styrofoam container or something. So I'm really interested in the power of the individual taking situations into their own hand with their own property. And I think in a time where people feel very impotent in the face of global challenges, you know, in a capitalist society, your private property is one of the few places you can make a visible radical shift in the world that you live in. And by doing it in the front yard, it becomes a very visible statement or activity or intervention that everyone around you enjoys and then thinks about too.
In some ways, it seems like these gardens blur the line between private and public space. If I'm working out in my front garden, that's very in full public view, and yet it's still my property and something that I own and am cultivating.
Exactly. I'm so interested in that. And coming from a background in architecture, what I think a lot about is how we make cities for ourselves, how we create places for ourselves to live, and how those places represent our priorities and our goals and what we believe in. And I think you can see the way we've made cities for definitely the last 50 years is really about isolation. It's about isolation on all levels, within the home, within the city, people, individuals from each other within the home, families from each other within neighborhoods, residential neighborhoods from where you work or where you play or whatever.
I actually wanted to ask you about that. You wrote in the book that today's towns and cities are being engineered for isolation. Can you give me an example of that? What are cities doing that encourages that, and how can they discourage that kind of isolation?
Well, one interesting thing to do is look at a map of any city, particularly in a place like Los Angeles, and you can look at the way cities have evolved over time. You can see, in particular, I think it's very helpful to look at recent housing developments on the periphery of cities, because you can see what happens is that the home developer has taken a role in the making of cities that has been quite radical. You can see the way these housing developments, even if they're not gated communities, are very isolated worlds where the whole street patterns are different. There's a lot of dead ends. There's maybe only a few points of entry into this development, as opposed to previous sorts of developments, even in the 50s, where there may be a new housing development in a city, but it wove itself into the fabric in the network of the city of local streets and local retail environments and things like that. New housing communities tend to isolate themselves into these kind of fiefdoms that are only homes. So anyone who lives there has to get in a car, even to buy milk or eggs or something like that. I mean, that's the most obvious one that many Americans live with on a daily basis. I think a lot of that isolation started with an industrial revolution where we really did need to separate power plants, coal production, factories, industry from where people lived. I mean, there was functional reason for that, but we don't need that as much today. And I think thoughtful urban design now is looking at how we can weave living and working and retail all together in a way. But yeah, back to your point about public and private front lawns, that's what the project's all about. It's taking space that's officially private, but looking at its possibility for being also public. So this space really has two functions. And really, if you look at the front yard and how it functions today, it is acknowledged as a semi-public space that when people get mad because someone doesn't mow their lawn, it's because they're acknowledging the fact that that lawn isn't just the lawn of that family's. It belongs to the whole street in a way. And it's what you do there says something about how you want to be connected to the people on your street. So people get really upset when someone doesn't mow their lawn because it says that they don't care about them. I'm really interested in how that space of the front lawn, we can take it back into a more thoughtful space that acknowledges its really public nature.
Very interesting. Well, best of luck with the upcoming projects.
Thanks so much.
Fritz Haig, thank you for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you.
Fritz Haig is the artist and author of Edible Estates, Attack on the Front Lawn. He spoke to us from his home in San Francisco. In this week's City Views commentary, Walker Smith says living with inexhaustible limits can be exhausting.
Writing in a recent issue of Harper's Magazine, author, social critic, and farmer Wendell Berry offered an intriguing observation about our ongoing struggle to come to terms with the new world of limits that confronts us everywhere we turn nowadays. Oil, food, time, money, climate, the environment, fishing, you name it. We're running up against the need to be more disciplined, less profligate, and more accommodating in our consumption of scarce resources. As Berry notes, failing to heed limits means living as if everything is available to us in endless quantities. Nothing requires that we curtail our appetites. We live with no limits to our desires and ambitions. We aspire to consume more and more, ever greater amounts at an ever-increasing rate. Not because we require it, but because living with no limits means we can endlessly indulge our greed. We live with insatiable appetites that overtake us and lead to dissatisfaction because more fails to ever be enough. This is not literary fancy. This is reality. Social psychologists refer to this as the hedonic treadmill. When we compare what we have to those around us, we never feel we have enough. No matter how much we have in an absolute sense, relatively speaking, there is always more that we can have or do in order to keep up or move ahead of those around us. It is a never-ending treadmill. We run and run without ever finishing. And this is the fundamental reason why money and material things are totally uncorrelated with happiness. The more we have absolutely, the more we lack relatively, and thus we are no happier than before. Berry's point, though, is not this well-worn analysis of happiness and satisfaction. Instead, he asks us to think differently about limits. He accepts the human need for no limits. He simply suggests that it is only by living within limits that we can transcend them. When we incorporate an acceptance of limits within our lifestyles, then and only then are we truly freed from the confines of limits. Again, this is not literary fancy. This is how nature actually works. Berry reminds us that intact ecosystems are inexhaustible. These ecosystems operate within limits. Each part of the web of life must play its part within the limits of tolerance. But if these limits are observed, then the ecosystem goes on and on endlessly. It is unlimited because it operates within limits. As Berry puts it, quote-unquote, some things, though limited, are inexhaustible. In order for us to live without constraint, we must live with discipline. And discipline means imposing limits on ourselves. When we live within limits, then we have an unlimited future. But we live now as if there are no limits. And that sort of insatiable greed is rapidly running headlong into limits. Yes, there is a paradox at work here. Limits transcend themselves, while life with no limits quickly runs dry. Overconsumption is a way of life to which we have become accustomed. But it is unsustainable, and we are facing the choice right now to find limits that work or run headlong over the brink. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Want to learn more about our guest this week? Well, check out our website, smartcityradio.com. We have links there to the work of the Chicago Architecture Foundation and Edible Estates. And while you're there, send us a note or let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com. You can also listen to archive shows, sign up for our weekly newsletter, or subscribe to our podcast. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our vacationing producer and engineer. He had additional help this week from Madeline Bayer. I'm Carol Coletta. This is Smart City.